Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to be gathering around the virtual water cooler and talking about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Brad, I wanted to read a couple of listener emails before we get started. Yi Feng from Boston wrote in responding to our discussion about Moana 2 being converted from a TV show into a theatrical feature film. And I was expressing some concern about that, but Yi Feng reminded me in this email that Toy Story 2, which was originally being planned as a direct-to-video release, but ended up being revamped for theatrical, and that scenario worked out pretty well. Do you have any thoughts about the Moana 2 thing being converted from a show into a movie that's coming out like in November?
I have this pretty much the same reservations that I feel like you already expressed, especially because Disney back in the day, they used to do a really like just crappy phoned in animated sequels. And this kind of feels like maybe they felt like they could easily salvage a TV series and turn it into a theatrical release at a time when they weren't going to have a lot of theatrical releases on the table because of like the actor strike and whatnot. And maybe they're trying to like maybe get a little bit more money out of this than they otherwise would have. I guess that's probably my biggest concern.
Yeah. I hope that there's enough time between now and November when this thing actually comes out that they will be able to give it the Toy Story 2 treatment and sort of, yeah, revamp what they need to and devote the resources necessary to make this as good as it can be. Because I think a lot of people really, really love that first Moana movie and be very disappointed if the sequel ends up sucking. So we will see about that. And then Sue from Colorado wrote in, I just wanted to read this real quick. She said, your reviews of old films are always interesting, and I was thrilled to listen to your review of The Ghost and Mrs. Muir this week. It's been my all-time favorite movie for decades, a lovely blend of romance, comedy, history, ghost story, and drama, along with having a wonderful score. I'm so happy that you enjoyed it too. So thank you for that, Sue. And yeah, I just wanted to use this as an opportunity to recommend once again The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is a really, really fun movie. And I've got another old movie that I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. So let's get into it, Brad, here. I read A Farewell to Arms recently by Ernest Hemingway. What is your relationship to Hemingway's work?
Sparse.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I read The Sun Also Rises a couple years ago and did not really care for that very much. So I was like, all right, I'm going to give this another shot, this whole Hemingway thing, and read A Farewell to Arms, which I know is widely considered a masterpiece. But I personally found this to be extremely tedious to read in the first half when the protagonist is injured in World War I and is basically laid up at an Italian hospital and is forging this romance with one of his nurses. Thankfully, I thought it sort of picked up around the halfway point because it felt like things started actually happening and some narrative momentum was finally beginning to form. So that helped things out a little bit. But then the ending happens, which is like one of the, I'm not going to say what happens exactly, but it's one of the bleakest and most depressing endings that I've ever read in any book. So this was a real roller coaster for me. And I basically came away from the experience just being like, you know what? Hemingway just isn't one of my guys. So there's that. I'm the guy who has to say I didn't like A Farewell to Arms on a podcast. So,
well, but hey, I'm proud of you for reading classic books, because I am terrible when it comes to keeping up with old school literature.
Yeah, I am too. And one of my I don't really make New Year's resolutions this year, like in a strict way, but one of my sort of like loose aspirations, I guess, is to read 22 books in a year. And last year I read 11 books, and I was like, I'm just going to like get ambitious and try to double it.
Damn.
And so I don't know if I'm going to actually be able to keep up with that pace or whatever, but I wanted to try to mix a few classics in there just because it's so easy to just like get caught up in new stuff. And, you know, there are so many, like every time you do that, the accumulating pile of classics just that I've not read just seems to get bigger and bigger. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to finally sort of dig into some of these older things and try to check some off my list and things like that. And so unfortunately, A Farewell to Arms was not really my favorite experience. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't begrudge you not liking Hemingway anyway. He's from Oak Park, Illinois, which is a real yuppie rich suburb of Chicago. So fuck off, Ernest Hemingway.
That reminds me so much, Brad, the way that you said that, of the bit for the running gag from Parks and Rec about what is the next town over? It's like
Eagleton.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the way that that Pawnee residents would refer to Eagleton. That was very much that energy there. Okay, let's get into what we've been watching. What have you been watching recently?
A bunch of stuff. I've actually been on a little bit of a music documentary kick, just a short one, but I have some, my eyes on some other ones that I'm going to watch too, just to kind of keep it going. I watched The Greatest Night in Pop on Netflix, which is a documentary about the creation of the very famous, I guess you could say, charity song that they made back in the mid 80s. It was such a huge deal because they got like all of the biggest names in music to sing this song, We Are the World. And so like the documentary itself is about getting like this incredible superstar lineup together, which includes Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Cyndi Lauper, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, Huey Lewis, like you name it, like the biggest stars of music in the 80s. Were pretty much all there to record this song. And the documentary chronicles like how they got them all together, how Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie wrote the song, what the process of like what was of actually recording the song and shooting the music video, which they did simultaneously because they knew they were only ever going to have everybody in the same room that one time. So they didn't do it like how they probably would do it today by having like everyone record parts separately and mixing it together. They got everybody into the same studio to record this song one night after the American Music Awards. And it's just really cool to watch everyone talk about how it came together. And they have such great archival footage of when they did the recording, because they had like three or four cameras there recording what was happening the entire time. So it was very cool to just watch just like such incredible music royalty together singing and goofing around and whatnot.
Yeah, I saw this at Sundance and really, really enjoyed it. It's just like the bevy of footage that they had from inside of the room is really what like elevates this above anything else. Like they just have like a pure treasure trove there of really, really amazing stuff. Did you have like a particular moment or something that stood out to you of, you know, whether it was an interaction between two of these superstars or like somebody trying to nail a line or something like that really like... do you think that that's going to stick with you a lot?
So one of my favorite things was having Dan Aykroyd randomly be there. That was just a great little bit, and they never explain it. But there, Mike Ryan, though, over at UpRocks, he did an interview with the director, and he asked about that. And apparently they had a little bit where they did explain how Dan Aykroyd ended up being there, but it kind of interrupted like the flow of the overall movie, and it felt like they were taking like an unnecessary detour. But basically what it comes down to is like Dan Aykroyd, I mean, he essentially was a big recording star in his own right, because the Blues Brothers album was huge with John Belushi. But Dan Aykroyd remembers it that apparently he happened to be nearby because he was looking for a new business manager, but somebody thought that he was looking for a new talent manager, and the manager he was meeting with was like, hey, do you want to go over to this like We Are the World thing that they're doing over nearby? And he was like, yeah, sure. So, but I think two of my favorite things were, there's a great moment with Cyndi Lauper when she's recording her bit, and they can't figure out like this weird thing that's going on with the sound. They keep hearing like weird background noise or something like that. And it's really like kind of driving them crazy. And then they realize that all of her bracelets and necklaces she has on are making noise in the microphone.
Yep.
And then I also really respected how like Huey Lewis was, how he approached like his bit. Like it was really endearing seeing him get like nervous, like building up to the part that he had to do, especially mm-hmm. since he also had to like adapt on the spot to like change up what they were doing a little bit. And so that was just really cool to see.
Yeah, I love that. Man, I have to disagree with that director of that project, though. I feel like the Dan Aykroyd thing was so distracting to me, where I was just like, why the hell is he here?
Yeah.
What's going on? I would have loved that explanation to actually make it into the movie. But I'm glad that you told me now, and that now all of our listeners know as well, because I had no idea, and that was just going to be like bugging me for the rest of my life. So, okay, what else have you been watching, Brad?
So piggybacking off of that, I remembered that last year, Showtime released a documentary called Thriller 40, which was about, it was released in conjunction with the 40th anniversary of Michael Jackson's Thriller album. And it's about the making of that incredible album, which has an unbelievable amount of hits on it. This is the album that has Billie Jean and Beat It and Pretty Young Thing. Of course, Thriller, because that's obviously the title of the album. It has The Girl's Mind with Paul McCartney. So it was a huge album. It's one of the biggest selling albums of all time. One of the best albums ever made. And this is a really cool documentary that dives into just like where Michael Jackson's career was, what drove him to do Thriller. They talk to a lot of like the sound engineers and people who were like in the studio and the booth working on it with him at the time. And like for, obviously there's always been, you know, controversy surrounding Michael Jackson and whatnot. You know, and so like you take that all into consideration when you hear about all these things, but like it still doesn't change the fact that when you hear people talk about how Michael Jackson worked on music and like what he did for music, and just kind of like how much of a genius he was when it came to songwriting and doing these innovative things, both as like a singer and a dancer, and just kind of like this pop culture icon. It's just, this really like puts in perspective just how big this album was, how influential it was. It has a lot of great talking heads featuring people like Usher and whatnot, and just all the cool details about the album. They have the raw demos that Michael Jackson recorded himself, which when he like was writing songs himself, he would basically record all the different parts of the song like with his voice, kind of like an a cappella version in a way, like creating the instrumentals with his voice and like singing the lyrics. And there's some like moments in the lyrics where he doesn't have the full lyrics figured out. He just kind of sings a medley to the tune of what he knows is going to be there, even though mm-hmm. he hasn't figured out the lyrics yet. And that was really cool to hear those. And then there's also my favorite bit of this documentary is, and I forget what his specific role was, but he worked on the song Thriller with Michael Jackson. And so he's in this room surrounded by like all this recording equipment and like synthesizers in these big, like, you know, blocks that kind of like look like servers, but there's like little keyboards on them and like switchboards and everything. And he starts going through step by step. He's like, he doesn't tell you what song it is, but he starts bringing up little bits of it layer by layer. So he starts with a very simple like drum beat, and then he adds like a little thing. And each time he's adding something, he's explaining like what the inspiration was and like why they brought it in there and that kind of thing. And so like you hear it sounds familiar. You might pick it up as it's going along. And as he's doing it, like it sounds like this cool beat, you know, it's got a great rhythm to it and everything. And then all of a sudden he's like, and then we added this, and it goes, da-da, da-da. And it's like, holy shit. it was such a cool like way to hear like the song come together like that. But yeah, if you liked Michael Jackson's music, if you, you know, love Thriller as an album, and there's some great bits about the making of the Thriller music video as well, which was very cool. So yeah, I would encourage you to check that out. It's on Showtime/Paramount+.
Okay, cool. That's Thriller 40. Have you ever listened to the Song Exploder podcast, Brad?
No, but I watched some of the episodes because they turned it into a series on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When you're describing the way that that guy was walking through sort of like a step by step of the different layers of the song and stuff, that reminded me of Song Exploder. So I just wanted to recommend that to our listeners and to you if you hadn't seen that already or listened to that already, because that podcast and that show does a similar thing. And it's always just really, really cool to hear, you know, some of your favorite songs like broken down to the granular levels and stuff like that. So anyway, very cool. Okay, what else have you been watching?
I did some horror catch up from last year. So a couple things that I just didn't get around to watching and missed around their respective, you know, holidays, if you will. I watched The Exorcist Believer, which is David Gordon Green's attempt to do a new Exorcist sequel that follows in Halloween footsteps by kind of ignoring every other sequel that came after the original Exorcist. And I remember hearing a lot of like hate against this movie, that it was like bad and like,
oh yeah, its reputation is awful.
Yeah, but I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was particularly good. I just think it's like super forgettable. It doesn't necessarily do anything new as far as like exorcism movies are concerned. And it doesn't even come close to touching, you know, like the legacy of the Exorcist itself. If I had one major complaint about it, is it's how they choose to handle the legacy aspect of The Exorcist, because it kind of feels like they kind of slow rolled you and they're like, hey, come in to see this. And that's like, oh, nope, we're chucking that out the window. Mm. And I won't spoil that just in case anybody hasn't seen it yet, you know, even though it's been out for, you know, a few months now. But so I didn't dislike it, but I just was, I guess, underwhelmed by it, because I don't think it's terrible. It just hits all the same beats that you expect from your average exorcism movie, you know? So I think that if you're going to do an Exorcist sequel like this, you got to do something that at least feels somewhat refreshing. And it's gotta be more than, oh, this time it's two girls.
So it sounds like you have a middling reaction to it. I skipped it, Brad. Would you recommend that I watch it, even though you didn't like love it?
If you're like a completionist kind of thing, you know, like if you feel like you want to, you know, be in the know on what's going on with The Exorcist. But like, I don't think there's anything particularly. Yeah, it doesn't really have any drawing power, I think, for you to go out of your way to see it.
OK, yeah. I'm so curious to know what Universal and Peacock are going to do about the other two movies that I think they paid a combined $400 million for the rights to make three Exorcist movies. And they're like pot committed basically at this point. So I'm just really curious to see what they do, because that first movie, or most recent movie, I should say, did not perform very well at the box office. So yeah, we'll have to see how that shakes out. What did you think about the other horror movie that you saw?
I watched Thanksgiving, and this, on the other hand, was super satisfying in the silliest way possible. this movie was so much gorier than I anticipated. I think it's just because I forgot how crazy Eli Roth likes to get with these kinds of things. but man, there are some really great brutal kills in this movie, and it's very much an over the top kind of thing, where, you know, like the acting isn't particularly great, and there's, you know, some stuff that's a little absurd, but it has like a little bit of a Scream vibe to it in a way. And the Thanksgiving angle makes for some really interesting kills. And so I had some fun with it. It was very enjoyable.
Yeah, same here, definitely. Okay, what else have you been checking out?
I also caught up with some other 2023 movies. I caught Nimona, the animated movie that is nominated for Best Animated Film this year. And have you seen Nimona yet?
I have. I really liked it.
I really liked it too. But I do want to say this. I don't know. I would love to go and read more about the inspiration behind like the animation style and whatnot, because there was something about this animation style that kind of bugs me, because it feels incomplete. And I know it's an intentional choice to make it look the way it does, but it's. I like my animation when it's like, when it's pretty detailed, and this feels like an animation style that's somewhere in between like their first animatics and like the final product, where they haven't like added certain textures and things like that yet. And it kind of bugs me a little bit, because I like the character design. I like the production design. I really dug the kind of mix of like a medieval fantasy environment with a futuristic world. That was a very cool concept to see come to life. But just something about the animation style didn't always sit well with me. There are still some very beautiful shots in the movie that shined through, that I was like, oh wow, that looks great, you know. And it was kind of like in spite of my reservations about seeing that animation style brought to life. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what do you think about the animation?
I loved it. I just thought it was cool because I hadn't really seen anything that looked quite that way before, but I definitely understand. Like I've largely stayed away from a lot of the Star Wars animated shows just because I don't like physically how they look. Like the same. Aesthetic bugs me. Yeah. So I certainly can understand, you know, being averse to the idea of spending whatever 2 hours in a world that just kind of like looks, if not repulsive, some of the Star Wars stuff frankly looks pretty repulsive to me. And Nimona, it sounds like it did not reach that level for you, but like I totally get the idea of being like, ah, you know what? I just don't know if I can look at things that look this way for that long. So I didn't have that experience watching Nimona myself. But
thankfully the story and the characters were engaging enough that like I wasn't, you know, super bugged by it the entire time. Chloe Grace Moretz in particular as Nimona is great. She has like these really funny little mischievous devilish moments that I thought mm-hmm. were really funny. It's got some great dark comedy to it. But yeah, I really love the thematic elements of, you know, this idea of being othered, and just a good story, really great fantasy movie.
So have you seen all of the contenders now for best animated feature? Are you caught up on that category?
I haven't seen The Boy and the Heron, but that's just because, and I'm sorry, and I don't know if I'll get emails about this or people screaming in their car. I am not a Studio Ghibli person. I have not seen a single Miyazaki movie. HT told me, you know, what I need to hop on it. And I consider it every now and then. My kind of tied to the Nimona reaction is, I'm a little averse to anime as a style, mm-hmm. And so it's harder for me to get in. I've heard that the Studio Ghibli movies, especially Miyazaki, kind of transcends that, even if you don't really like anime, because the stories are so good. And there are aspects of the movies that, you know, I know about, you know, movies like My Neighbor Totoro and Spirited Away and whatnot, that they do sound like they could be very cool. I just haven't yet taking the time to like really try and dig into it. I will at some point, but yeah, so I haven't seen The Boy and the Heron.
I would personally recommend checking out The Castle of Cagliostro if that is still streaming on Netflix, because that was Miyazaki's first directorial movie, and that's still one of my favorites. It's one that's like not talked about really in the same sort of like respectful tones as a lot of those other Studio Ghibli movies that you just mentioned. But I think it's a really great entry point because the story is so much fun and the characters are so awesome, and it's like this great sort of heist adventure kind of thing. And I think you would really, really like it on that level. So if you're looking for, you know, a way to sort of dip your toe in, I would recommend Castle of Cagliostro. But
okay.
So actually, let's take a break. And then you have two more movies that we want to talk about. We'll be right back.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, Brad, you saw Dune Part 2. What did you think about it?
I did. And so I'll put this out there that I was not completely enamored or blown away by the first Dune. I liked it. I thought it was a pretty good sci-fi adventure, but it felt like half a movie to me because it is part one. And I just didn't get quite so wrapped up or engaged by it. I know Dune has a long legacy because of the novels and whatnot. And people just like that world. And I'm a big fan of Denis Villeneuve. You know, I love Arrival. And so I liked it, didn't love it. But I was very interested in Dune Part 2. The trailers looked great. You know, wanted to see how the story continued because Dune is not a book series that I kept up with, you know, when I was younger or even mm-hmm. now. So watching Dune Part 2 was a lot of fun. And I actually came away really liking this movie a lot. I liked it much more than the first movie. It is truly epic in scale, but it's the kind of movie that feels big and grand, but it doesn't feel overproduced. Obviously, it's like a big sci-fi blockbuster, and there's plenty of visual effects and things that go into it, but it all feels pretty tangible still. And it doesn't feel like there's nothing that looks terrible when it comes to the CGI or anything like that. So it never feels like it has this unnecessarily larger than life vibe to it. It just works as a big, grand, epic blockbuster. And it has, you know, really compelling story arcs for its characters, things that tie into, you know, religion and using religion as a weapon. I was particularly impressed by Timothée Chalamet in this movie. You know, I feel like most of the time he's got fairly limited range, but I was surprised to hear his line delivery in some of these scenes. He does effectively come off as being very intimidating. Austin Butler is great. He's a complete maniac in this movie. He just looks like a psychopath. Christopher Walken has a great bit part. There are some really cool action sequences, truly thrilling action sequences. And I can't recommend to you enough to make sure you see this in a theater that has like the top quality sound system, because I saw it in a Dolby Atmos theater and man, the sound just fucking blew me away. it was incredible sound. So yeah, really, really dug Dune 2. I was surprised I liked it as much as I did, because I wasn't expecting to come away. But it really is an incredible sci-fi movie.
Man, I'm so excited for this. I'm seeing it, I think, the Thursday that it opens, so like next Thursday. So I've got that date circled on my calendar. How was Florence Pugh in it? Is she like a very small role?
She's not in it as much as you would hope or think. She has a pretty small supporting role, and she's not given a ton to do. She's perfectly fine in it, and it's just because she doesn't have much of a role. So yeah. So put your expectations in check if you're really excited about seeing Florence Pugh.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. And then you also saw Drive Away Dolls, which is Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook's new movie. I think this one technically comes out this Friday. I've not seen this yet. What do you think about this one?
This was a lot of fun. This really feels like a throwback movie, a kind of comedic caper that would have come out in like the late 90s or something like that. There's even aspects to it that have kind of like a 1970s vibe as well. But yeah, in this movie, Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan play these two lesbians who are on the road. They're trying to take a little bit of a road trip, and they pick up a drive-away rental, which is like apparently a seemingly real thing that exists, where like you can go and pick up a car that's being dropped off somewhere, and it's like a one-way trip to get somewhere. And so they do that, but there's some nefarious things in the back of the car. If you've seen the trailer, you know what I'm talking about. And so they get kind of caught up in this world of like crime and intrigue and whatnot. It's has the kind of dark comedy and edginess you'd expect from a Coen Brothers movie, but it is super gay, very super lesbian movie, and Margaret and Geraldine they're both funny in it, and they make for a great duo on the road, and it's just very enjoyable. It really is just like a fun caper with just the right tinge of absurdity, the kind of silliness you would expect from one of the Coens.
Excellent. I'm very much looking forward to this as well, especially in this sort of like bleak period in the movie release calendar, when it seems like there's not really a lot out right around now. I'm glad that this movie is coming out and will give me something to look forward to. So, okay, I watched a documentary called Call Me Kate, which is about Katharine Hepburn, one of the greatest actresses of all time. It's sort of like a cradle to the grave look at her life. And while I thought there were like a few bright spots in this, I was ultimately left pretty disappointed. There are interviews with family members that are ostensibly there to kind of provide some personal insight, like a personal touch into the lives of these legends, especially Hepburn. And then the movie also talks a little bit about Spencer Tracy, her lover and frequent collaborator. But the family members that they get in this documentary are like so far removed from the actual subjects that their observations didn't really strike me as particularly revealing or even interesting in some cases. Like, I think Spencer Tracy's great-great-grandson talks about Spencer Tracy for a minute in this, and I'm like, I kind of feel like, you know, people who have written biographies about Tracy might know more about him than a relative that's that far separated, you know? It's just kind of a weird choice. So there are actual audio recordings of Katharine Hepburn herself, which are a little bit more enlightening. But to me, this kind of felt like the filmmakers didn't really have quite enough material to work with and were kind of like padding things out a little bit, which is not a great feeling to have when the movie itself is less than an hour and a half long. So anyway, it's on Netflix right now. If you're like a huge Katharine Hepburn fan but don't know anything at all about her life, I would recommend maybe checking it out under those circumstances. But like, I just wish this was a little bit more informative and insightful and interesting. So it's called Call Me Kate, if you want to check that out. I also watched Babette's Feast, which came out in 1987. The reason I watched this is because this is supposed to be, if you look up lists of like the best movies about food, Babette's Feast is often at the top of that list. And The Taste of Things, which was one of my favorite movies, it's weird to say, of last year. It had a limited release last year and technically came out like in wider release just like I think last week. So that movie is in theaters right now, The Taste of Things. Terrific, terrific movie. I think rivals Babette's Feast, if not bests it and will best it on all of these future lists of the best food movies. I think that movie is great. And so I was just in the mood to check out more movies about food. And this is a Danish movie, I believe. And it's about this woman who comes to basically be a servant in this very, very, very small 19th century Denmark town on a remote western coast. And most of the movie is just about the small town sort of religious life in this really, really isolated community. And then the character who is the servant, the chef, the cook, the whole deal at this house wins the lottery. And she decides that she is going to make a full like French meal, a French dinner for this group of people who live in this really small religious community. And they have taken a vow basically because they're so religious that they don't want to express any sort of emotion about the food. They think that it, you know, that's a sin or something like that, right? So like they're being treated to this sumptuously prepared meal. Like the entire back 45 minutes, last 45 minutes or hour of this movie or something is dedicated to this character making this incredible meal and serving it to these people. And then you just, as the audience, you're just watching them eat and have this like, you know, transformative once in a lifetime experience of eating this amazing food, but being under these restrictions where they can't really talk about how amazing the food is. So it's just a fun sort of dynamic there. And like, yeah, the scenes where this character Babette actually like makes the food and serves it to these folks are just like really stunning. And it's one of those movies that you absolutely should not watch on an empty stomach. So I thought like for the first, I don't know, hour or so, I was like, is this really like a food movie? Like they really are going to have to stick the landing on this for this to justify its placement on all of these lists that I've seen it on. And then because there's really not a lot of food stuff at all in the first half of the movie or whatever. But then it really comes through in the end. So Babette's Feast is streaming on Max right now. And I recommend checking out if you like food stuff.
Okay.
Have you ever seen Gilda, Brad? The movie, you might recognize the movie Gilda from the scene in The Shawshank Redemption where there's a movie night in the jail or in the prison, and Morgan Freeman's character and Tim Robbins' character are talking, and Morgan Freeman's like, wait a second, I love this part, or something like that, and the camera cuts to the screen that they're watching, and Rita Hayworth like throws her, like comes up into frame and throws her hair back, and everybody in the jail like freaks out. Have you ever seen Gilda?
No, I haven't. I'm like, you know, it's one of those movies where I'm aware of its legacy, especially because Rita Hayworth has that famous quote where it's like every man I knew, they went to bed with Gilda and woke up with me.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's crazy. So anyway, I really enjoyed this movie. It's about a small time American gambler who is in Argentina, and he meets up with this casino owner and ends up becoming the casino owner's right hand man. And everything seems to be going really well until the owner leaves on a business trip and then comes back with a wife who just so happens to be the gambler's ex-girlfriend. And that is the Rita Hayworth character, Gilda. From there, it's basically like a series of psychological power plays in order to establish dominance in this triumvirate that they've established. And it's, it's just a very, very entertaining movie. It came out in 1946. Charles Vidor directed it. Glenn Ford plays one of the main roles, and he was really great in like The Big Heat, for example. So it's got a good cast, and this is one of the yeah, certainly like one of the biggest Rita Hayworth movies out there. So check it out. It's called Gilda. It's streaming on Tubi right now. If you want to watch that, I think you can watch it just like for free with ads, basically. And the last thing I wanted to mention is I rewatched The Sting for the first time in a long time. Have you ever seen The Sting, Brad?
Yes, I have. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I did watch it and it's very good.
Yeah, just such a blast. I mean, this is like one of the great con man movies of all time. It stars Paul Newman and Robert Redford. And it's just, I mean, I'm not going to get into like the ins and outs of what happens because that's sort of like the joy of watching this movie. But if you like things like The Brothers Bloom or, yeah, any sort of con man type of thing, David Mamet's House of Games, for example, you got to go back and check out the Sting, which is just like a really one of the all time classics in this subgenre. Newman and Redford are so much fun to watch. And Robert Shaw, I mean, if you only know him from his work as Quint in Jaws, this is a really fun Robert Shaw performance because he plays the villain in this. Like really good music, memorable production design, like everything looks cool and sort of came together in the right way. I think this was nominated for something like 10 Oscars and it won 7 of them. So just a real classic movie. I had no idea that a sequel was made because one of the things that happens there is a con that's pulled on somebody in this movie, unsurprisingly. And so at the end of the movie, as the credits were rolling, I was kind of thinking like, I wonder what happened after this movie ended. Like these characters, several of them are still alive. So like, I wonder what happened in the continuation of this story. And then I discovered that there's a movie called The Sting 2, which is apparently terrible. I've never seen it. And it like recast everybody and like none of the original players came back or anything. I think maybe the original writer came back or something, but otherwise it was just like, oh boy, I'm probably going to be skipping that one, just pretending that it doesn't exist. So anyway, I would recommend watching The Sting, which is on Netflix right now, if you want to check out.
George Roy Hill as a filmmaker has such an eclectic career. So he did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Sting, probably his two most famous movies. But then he also did Slapshot with Paul Newman.
Oh, wow.
He did The World According to Garp. He did Slaughterhouse-Five. And then his last movie was Funny Farm, of all things, with Chevy Chase. And I just recently watched Funny Farm for the first time not too long ago. And when I saw that George Roy Hill directed, I was like, what?
Yeah, that is quite an eclectic collection there. That is, yeah, he's like all over the place in terms of genres and stuff. I mean, I guess that's like, I feel like filmmakers were more, I don't know, they were maybe given more leeway to do that back in the day, especially back in like the old golden age where people were just like cranking out, you know, multiple movies a year and all of that. But yeah, I guess the 70s, like maybe people had more freedom to bounce around in genres and maybe weren't quite as pigeonholed as they are now. But shout out to George Roy Hill, who did a terrific job with The Sting. Okay, let's get into what we've been eating. What have you been eating recently, Brad?
I've been trying some new stuff. There's a big fast food crossover in these items. I only just now realized after I cherry picked things I want to talk about. So when I went to London for the Argyle Junket, whenever I get the opportunity to travel abroad, it's pretty much only been England, except for Australia that one time. But I always try to get some cool treats that are available over there because they have unique chips and chocolates and other snacks and stuff that are only available in the UK, and I like to get them to try them. And so one of them that I tried was there's a popcorn brand called Proper Popcorn, and they have a flavor of popcorn where it's seasoned like KFC, as in like the fried chicken seasoning recipe.
Like a piece of chicken,
like the seasoning that makes up all the flavors and spices of the breading on the Kentucky Fried Chicken, basically.
Okay.
So I just had to try it. And it's surprisingly good. It's very, very peppery, has some great flavor to it. And it really did remind me of the seasoning that comes on the original recipe chicken that you would get from Kentucky Fried Chicken, or KFC as it's better known now.
Wow. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm just kind of surprised that flavor would go well with popcorn. But
yes, and they actually have they didn't have them there, or at least I couldn't find them while I was there. They also did some potato chips that have the same seasoning, and rotisserie chicken itself actually is a popular regular flavor of potato chip over in the UK. So there you go.
Who knew? Okay.
Yeah. I also tried, Wendy's has a new breakfast item. They have a breakfast burrito. And I know that when you think of Wendy's, you think, I would love a burrito from Wendy's. but breakfast burritos are a little bit easier to come by if you're not necessarily doing Mexican food. And so they take their breakfast foods. They take some eggs, bacon, a little bit of sausage, and they have this special cheese sauce that they put, wrap it in a tortilla, a little bit of their potato wedges that they have at breakfast as well, and they put it in a breakfast burrito, and it's solid. I actually really enjoy Wendy's breakfast options. It's, you know, they kind of similar to how like their quality of burger is a little bit better than like McDonald's or Burger King. I kind of feel the same way about, I would say, like maybe like half of their breakfast menu, and it's mostly because of the breakfast Baconator, I think, is particularly good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the breakfast burrito is solid. If I really want like the better fast food breakfast burrito, Taco Bell is like the place that you should go to. But I enjoyed it for the most part.
Okay, well, speaking of Taco Bell, you tried something from there, right?
Yeah, they have a new item, the cheesy chicken. Actually, I put empanada here, but it's crispinada, actually, because people love making up words. and so it's an empanada. The exterior is very much like the caramel apple empanada that they used to have on their menu, which was like a dessert item. But it is the fried empanada shell, and inside of it, it has their shredded chicken. And a cheese sauce and a little bit of their chipotle sauce as well. And that's actually really good. It gets a little hairy as you get towards the middle because it's very goopy because of like it's just like chicken and sauce inside of it. So you got to be careful because otherwise it'll, you know, drip down your chin and it can be potentially messy. But it's solid if you like Taco Bell's, you know, cheesy chicken offerings.
Okay. This next thing you're going to talk about, I actually saw on the shelf in my store. I feel like a lot of the stuff that you talk about is like relatively obscure for me, but I don't really, you know, go out and seek out these wild foods that you're always eating. But this one made its way to the shelves of my local Publix. Tell me about this next
thing. There you go. Yeah. So there's a new flavor of Goldfish, strawberry shortcake is what it's called. It's inspired by Hello Kitty. You'll see Hello Kitty on the bag because people love Hello Kitty, I guess. And the flavor is inspired by the dessert strawberry shortcake. And so the goldfish themselves, they're not the cracker goldfish. They're like the graham cookie goldfish. And they're coated in this strawberry flavored dust, which to me, when I ate them, was very reminiscent of Crunch Berries from Captain Crunch.
Oh, yeah.
And so it basically tastes like they crunched up Crunch Berries and just dusted them all over these graham crackers. And so that, to me, that was delicious. I really liked it. And so the combination of the strawberry with the graham does make for a good strawberry shortcake combination. There's not necessarily any cream aspect to it, which I feel like was maybe the one thing that was missing. Maybe they could have put like a little bit of some kind of glaze on the grahams or something like that. But but otherwise, it's a nice sweet cookie sort of treat.
Before we get into your last thing here, I have to ask you, like, because you're constantly trying so many new things, do you even have a normal rotation of snacks that you go to, or are you constantly in the zone of like, all right, well, there's like 15 things that I need to try. So like you never really fall back on your old reliables.
No, I definitely have like my old standbys because like I need a break in between stuff because oftentimes, not oftentimes, but like sometimes I'll get something and it's not something that I like very much, or it's not something that I want to particularly like snack on regularly. It's like, oh, okay, I'm glad I tried that. And then like I'll have other people try it, or I'll take it to somebody's, you know, house for like, you know, so everyone can try it like at a party or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I definitely have like regular standby things. Like I love dark russet potato chips from Utz. You know, mm-hmm. I like nacho cheese Doritos. I love a good regular Oreo. I definitely have, you know, my standbys of things that I'll normally get for that I know that I'm going to want to snack on at some point.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, so tell me about this last thing here.
This last thing is easily one of the weirdest things I have ever tried, and once I heard about it, I could not resist getting it to try to find out what it tasted like, because it was just too intriguing to let by. And so I saw this because another snack person that I follow on Instagram posted about this. There's this chocolate company, and I don't know if it's just TCHO or if it's pronounced Cho, But they it's Cho, and they make their chocolate company online. And they there was a very limited edition chocolate that they offered that was called Choco Nachos, N-A-T-C-H-O-S, inspired by the, you know, their name. And what it promised was the flavor of nachos, as in nachos and cheese, in chocolate form.
What?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I could see, like, aesthetically, you know, like creating a chocolate thing that looks like a nacho, but how in the hell did they get the flavor, or did they get the flavor into the actual chocolate?
That was what was so mind-blowing, because they really did get the flavor of nachos into this square of chocolate. Now, and so chocolate by itself is not naturally sweet. It's usually, it's sweetened by sugar. So to have chocolate that doesn't have a sweetness to it isn't surprising itself. But what is surprising to it is that they were able to get the flavor of meat and cheese and spice into this. And so, like,
oh my God, the got meat in there?
Yeah, and the texture of tortilla chips, because it has a little bit of a crunch to it as well. And so here's what the ingredients are, or the chocolate is made with: cocoa butter, tortilla chips, garlic, chives, red peppers, onions, cilantro, tomatoes, jalapenos, cayenne pepper, and extra smoked paprika. It's all in this little chocolate square that is like the size of a Starburst, basically. And it was, they only made 500 little bags of this. It was a very limited batch. They sent me a bag after I requested to try it, because I just couldn't let it go. I was just like, how does this taste? And it's so confusing, because you put it in your mouth, and it's, you know, so, and you chew it a little bit, and it's strange because you don't expect this kind of flavor to come from something with this kind of texture.
Yeah.
It has the texture of like a chocolate square as you're chomping it up, but then you start feeling you feel a little, taste the cheese, you feel like the spiciness, the meat flavor is there, there's a little bit of crunch from the tortilla chips. And after you're chewing it and it starts melting in your mouth, it just feels like you just took a bite of a chip that had chips and cheese and whatnot on it. It was such a weird thing. Like, I imagine that eating this was very similar to how it would feel to have that gum that has a 3-course meal in it from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah. It was just a very strange experience to have. It wasn't a bad flavor either. I was expecting to be grossed out by it, because, like, I'm the person who I will say, like, the weirdest thing that I've probably tried and simultaneously the grossest is they came out with one time they did these taco truck jelly beans, and one of them was salsa, and that was fucking disgusting. And then they did this tailgate bag of candy corn, and two of the candy corn, one was hot dog and the other one was hamburger, and those almost made me throw up. but this, the flavor was genuinely good. It was just a weird texture combination that, like, my mind was like, wait a minute, how is this happening? It's not the kind of thing where, like, I would sit and have several bites of this, but I was not, like, grossed out or anything by it. It was just a confusing flavor experience, but I was happy to have tried it.
Wow. Yeah, that is kind of mind-blowing. So Choco Nachos from TCHO. It sounds like it was pretty limited. Do you know
I know the number on my bag was 356 out of 500, and this was around the time that, like, the Super Bowl was happening, so I would imagine they're probably sold out by now. But at the very least, keep an eye on their website, because they do have some cool flavors, and I'm sure that they offer other unique things from time to time. So
very cool. Okay. The last thing here is the what we've been playing section. I just wanted to mention that I played Spider-Man 2 for the PS5. I got a PS5 like right after Christmas, and the first Spider-Man game from 2018 I reviewed for Slash Film, so I had like a very, very limited amount of time to play the game. I think I had to play through the entire thing in like 3 days in order to write the review and meet the embargo time. But this time the game's been out for a little while, so I like definitely took my time with it and really enjoyed playing this. It's basically it's a darker story. It's like the Empire Strikes Back of Spidey stories. They do some really interesting things with like the typical Spider-Man canon, like upending a lot of established ideas, specifically the origins of Venom, who is a major force in this game, and like how Dr. Connors, aka the Lizard, lost his arm, and there are a few more things that I won't spoil here. I found the story to be pretty fascinating and compelling. And then, like, in terms of the actual, like, game mechanics, there's the introduction of something called web wings, which are basically like flying squirrel wings between Spider-Man's arms and his torso, which totally changes the dynamic of traveling around the virtual New York City in this game. And like, I can't imagine going back to the way that the first game was, which I loved at the time and still love.
I assume it makes it a lot easier.
It's so much easier and it's so much fun because you're basically just like, it's almost like you have the ability to be Spider-Man at any time, but you also can be like, Superman is too strong because you're not really powered while you're flying. It's more like falling with style, you know, more like gliding. So maybe like Batman or something like that, like the bat wings or whatever. But yeah, you can basically just like gain a bunch of speed swinging through the city and then just pop out these wings and just like cruise through the sky. It's so cool. So much fun.
Nice.
And so, yeah, this game is just a total blast. And it looks incredible. Like the character design actually looks really bad, like super jarring compared to the first game. The actual like what Peter Parker, the human man, and what like Mary Jane Watson and Miles Morales, some of the main characters actually look like compared to the character models of the first game. I was like, Jesus Christ, like this is supposed to be the better version. Like PS5 is supposed to be better than PS4. Like what did they do here? But you eventually sort of get used to it. And then everything else in the game looks unbelievable. So it's very easy to, you know, sort of like overcome that little hurdle. But I think there were a lot of people like clowning on the character designs when this game first came out. So anyway, is this one that's like sort of on your long list, Brad? I know that on previous episodes of this podcast, you talk about how you're like 5 years behind when it comes to video game stuff. But
yeah, well, I think I mentioned too that I would love to have a PlayStation 5 and Spider-Man 2, and no one at Sony sent me a PlayStation 5. So
yeah, they weren't listening to that episode, unfortunately. Yeah,
pretty bummed. No, but actually, one of my friends who has a PlayStation 5 actually just recently let me borrow his because he's more into the computer side of gaming now, and he hasn't been playing his PlayStation 5 as much, and he already made it through Spider-Man 2. So
you gotta play it.
Yeah, I'm gonna hop on soon and I'm gonna play that. And he also let me borrow and he also has Star Wars Jedi Survivor. So since I just recently beat Fallen Order, finally I'm gonna try and tackle both of those sequels here pretty soon.
Nice. Okay, yeah, awesome. Well, you have to come back on and tell me about that once you speed through those. So cool. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find a lot more of the things that we talked about at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to our newsletter, send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailback topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends, spread the word. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.